Good day. Today is Friday, 14th November 2025. And before I proceed with the rest of the video, let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched and listened to the video or whatever part of the video you want to watch and listen to, and you decide that you've liked what you've heard and want to indicate that fact. Now, let me first begin with, again, another brief discussion of the situation in my own country, the political situation in my own country, which is Britain. Again, apologies to those outside Britain for whom this is perhaps somewhat parochial topic. And by the way, apologies also to some people in Britain who I suspect are also, shall we say, less than excited by this story. But over the last couple of days, as I discussed in my programme yesterday, there were clear signs that British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer is on the ropes, that his political position is collapsing, and that his future as Prime Minister is narrowing basically by the hour. Well, the event which precipitated this crisis, this political crisis, if crisis is the right word, deliverance, some people would say. Anyway, the event that precipitated this was a speech given about a week ago by the British Finance Minister, Rachel Reeves, in which she indicated that the Labour government was about to raise the general rate of income tax, breaking in the process a promise given by the Labour Party before the last general election. Well, surprise, surprise, as it became clear that Keir Starmer's electoral political position was collapsing. Last night, we got news that the general rate, the increase in the general rate of income tax, which had precipitated this whole crisis, that has now been called off. We are being told that this is because there has now been an updated forecast of the state of the country's finances, and that this increase in taxation is no longer necessary. Well, you can believe that if you wish, but if you do, all I can say is that I have a bridge to sell you. Clearly, the Prime Minister has realised that he doesn't have the political capital, the political support, even within his own party, to push such an increase in general taxation through. So we are not going to see the increase in general taxation that a week ago we were being told was absolutely necessary, essential, in order to stabilise Britain's finances. And this morning, even as I make this programme, there are signs that the international markets, the financial markets, are worried and unhappy that Britain's borrowing costs are rising and that there is, again, pressure on the international rating of Britain's currency, the pound sterling. Well, there we are. I've said in many programmes now that Britain doesn't have a government. We have no government in Britain. We have only administration. We have administration instead of government. The government is unable to make major policy decisions about the economy, about pretty much anything else. And we've now had further proof. It cannot cut welfare spending. It cannot increase taxes. It has no economic plan, no political authority or capital, despite a 160 plus majority in the House of Commons. It cannot take any step in terms of the actual government of Britain. It can administer, but it cannot govern. As Some would say it is in office, but not in power. Well, there it is. Britain is drifting, and it will continue to drift. The only thing that the government, the opposition, the entire political class remain united about, the only thing they can do is to continue their economic and political struggle against Russia, an immeasurably more powerful country than Britain, just to say, and one which is in close alliance with China, which is magnitudes, orders of magnitude, more powerful still. But never mind about that, never mind about the fact that the United States, Britain's ally, has at times shown flickers of doubt about the wisdom of this whole enterprise. Just plough on, just continue to advocate more sanctions against the Russians, even though that makes Britain's own economic problems worse. Continue to supply weapons to Zelensky and to Ukraine, even though this reduces still further the combat capability of Britain's already disastrously diminished armed forces. Go on transferring billions of pounds each year to Zelensky's budget, ignoring the reports of massive corruption in the process in Ukraine, which have now burst out into the open. And of course, in the process, make the budgetary crisis in Britain, which, by the way, despite what the government is pretending this morning, is indeed very real. Just go on making that even worse. That's the only thing you can actually do. You can't actually do anything else. Anything else, if you try to do it, runs into too much opposition. It puts the Prime Minister's position in jeopardy. It puts the entire government's position in jeopardy. So just go on doing that, even as it makes the overall condition of the country worse. Now, just to say a number of things here, I've discussed in many programmes now how our Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, goes out of his way to embrace the Zelensky curse. It's perhaps fair to say that he's not the only one. The entire British political class is doing the same thing, and by doing it, they are making the entire country embrace the Zelensky curse. That is the first thing I wanted to say. The second is that, of course, Keir Starmer himself has only bought himself a small amount of time, perhaps a few more weeks, by this latest U-turn. His attempt to raise taxes and then his decision to cancel them, though it will calm the mood for a few days amongst his parliamentary party, it leaves nothing ultimately resolved. In a few weeks' time, all the worries, all the stresses, all the fears, all the concerns will come back with renewed force. And in the meantime, of course, what he has done underlines the fact that he is a weak prime minister, unable to make strong decisions, unable to lead the country or even his own party. The French Prime Minister of the 1950s, Pierre Mendès France, said that to govern is to choose. In the case of Keir Starmer, he cannot choose, he cannot govern. All he can do is support his friend Vladimir Zelensky and Ukraine. That is all he has, that is all that is left to him. Anyway, let me continue with the rest of the programme. And we have had further rather dramatic developments in Ukraine over the last 24 hours. Over the last 24 hours, the Russians last night conducted another massive drone and missile strike against Ukraine. And this one appears to have centered heavily on Kiev itself. And it appears to have targeted the Kiev's energy system. Apparently, two power facilities close to Kiev itself were specifically targeted. Now, I have not been able to get a sense of the precise dimensions of this strike, but it does appear to have been a very big one, comparable to the one that took place about a week ago. And I don't yet have a clear sense of the damage. We will no doubt get more information about that by tomorrow. And no doubt the Russian Defense Ministry will have provided its own account of this attack, as the Ukrainian Defense Ministry will also do. What I will say is that over the course of the last attack, we did see for the first time in several strikes signs that Ukraine's air defenses were operating again, if only after a fashion. There were pictures appeared of the launch of Patriot missile interceptors. We haven't seen those for a while. About a couple of weeks ago, reports appeared that Ukraine had received more Patriot missile systems from Germany and Israel. So they have presumably arrived, and no doubt that was what we saw flickering into action last night. My own sense is that these missiles made little impact on the effect of the overall strike. I understand that the entire systems were provided. The number of actual interceptors of missiles, Patriot missiles, that was provided was limited. I can't speak with any certainty about this, but that's what I sense. And already Vladimir Zelensky is begging for more Patriot missiles. He talks about Ukraine's lack of Patriot missile interceptors, that Ukraine is short of them, it's short of air defenses. As we will see in a moment, he recently, over the last 36 hours, he left Kiev. He went to Zaporozhye. He went to Pokrovsk, the area around Pokrovsk. He went to Zaporozhye region. He visited the town of Orekhov. He visited the headquarters of the Ukrainian brigade that is stationed in Orekhov. He had some actually quite interesting things to say, but then as soon as that trip was ended, he returned to Kiev, took the train from Kiev, presumably, travelled, I guess, to Poland, took a jet and flew to Greece. And he arrived in Athens, and he has been begging the Greek Prime Minister, Kostas Mitsotakis, for Greece's Patriot missile systems. I believe Greece has three, and its remaining Mirage 2000 jets. Ukraine has, of course, already received a small batch of Mirage 2000s from France. I can't say that I can see that they're making any difference. They're proving every bit as ineffectual as the F-16s have. But nonetheless, Zelensky has come to Greece, to Athens, to beg for Greece to give Ukraine all that it still has, which leads me to think that this latest Russian attack has quite probably depleted significantly whatever remaining Patriot missiles Ukraine actually has. No doubt it got a few more as part of these latest deliveries, But the batch that it was supplied has already been significantly depleted by this one big Russian strike. So he needs more, or he pretends to need more, and he's gone to Greece and he's asking for them. Now, I should say that up to now, the Greeks have been very unwilling to supply Patriot missiles and Mirage 2000s. Greece also received, as I remember, air defense missiles from Russia once upon a time. This was when relations between Russia and Greece were quite good. It was persuaded to give those up and to transfer them to Ukraine on the promise that it would receive Patriot missile systems in their place. The reason, of course, why Greece needs or believes it needs strong air defences is because it is in a permanent conflict with Turkey, and it feels that it needs to have a strong air defences in order to counter Turkey's otherwise very considerable military superiority, both in northern Greece, in Thrace, and also in the Aegean Sea. Well, no doubt the political pressures from Brussels, maybe even from Washington, to transfer whatever air defence systems Greece has to Ukraine, maybe those will now grow. I can't imagine that Ursula von der Leyen and Kaya Kallas and Friedrich Merz and Emmanuel Macron and all of these people are particularly concerned about Greece's security concerns. The big question is whether the Greek government is interested in defending or securing Greece's security concerns. I have my personal doubts about that. I would not be surprised if Greece does indeed agree to part with whatever air defences it has left, or a significant part of them. Then, of course, if it does, it will all be for nothing, because all of these missiles that Greece will give to Ukraine will quickly be used up, and Zelensky inevitably is going to come back and ask for more again, and always more, because, of course, he never gets enough. Because he cannot get enough. Supplying Ukraine with weapons, especially air defense weapons, is like trying to inflate a balloon which has a hole in it. You can blow air into the balloon for as much as you wish. You can leave yourself desperately short of breath. But as soon as you stop blowing, the balloon will deflate again. It is bewildering that people in Europe especially, and so much of the commentariat, never get this. You still see endless demands, give Ukraine more weapons. All they need are a few more weapons. We're not giving them enough. We've given them enough to defend themselves, but never enough to win. That narrative continues to be peddled day after day, week after week. The reality is that there is never enough. And given the realities, the enormous imbalance in military power and production capacity between Russia and Ukraine, and indeed even between Russia and the West, just to say, whatever number of weapons the West can afford to supply will never resolve the underlying problem. Anyway, there it is. We'll see what Zelensky himself gets up, manages with the Greeks. And we'll see what else the Europeans can come up with. I should say that there is a new narrative doing the spreading across Europe, which is that one of the reasons why Ukraine has been losing ground in so many places in the battlefields, supposedly, is because of the American government shutdown. This has supposedly brought weapons deliveries to Ukraine practically to a stop. Again, I don't know why people continue to fall for these stories. I doubt that weapons deliveries to Ukraine from the United States have stopped. And besides, what prevents European governments, who are supposed to be financing these weapons deliveries, from contacting directly the weapons suppliers, and indeed the Pentagon, and trying to get the weapons? After all, the whole problem with the American shutdown is supposed to be a cutting off of funds. Isn't that precisely what the Europeans are supposed to be giving the United States in return for the weapons? Of course, the reality is the United States is short of weapons, or at least certain types of weapons, and the Europeans are short of money, or at least some types of money, money from the European budget, to be precise. But it is nonsense to say that it is the American shutdown that is the source of Ukraine's existing problems. Of course, there are alternative views. Friedrich Merz, the Chancellor of Germany, is again basically saying that the major problem why Ukraine isn't able to withstand the Russian advance is because it won't conscript younger people. And he is complaining angrily about the fact that Ukrainians are coming to Germany rather than staying in Ukraine and fighting for their country. Zelensky, by the way, has given a rather sharp response to this. He says that Ukraine is recruiting 30,000 men a month, a figure, by the way, which I believe to be wildly exaggerated. But anyway, Ukraine is recruiting 30,000 men at once, that he understands the situation on the battlefronts, that those who don't, in Europe and in the United States and elsewhere, have no right to pontificate about this topic. Just for once, just on this one occasion, I find myself agreeing with him, by the way. I find the whole business of European governments and American politicians trying to strong arm the Ukrainians into rounding up and sending more and more of their people to the slaughter, I find it absolutely chilling. But anyway, that narrative is also there, that Ukraine is not short of manpower, it's just not using its manpower efficiently. It is not really coping with the demands of the war, and that what it needs to do is to just round up more of its people, especially its young people, and send them to the battlefronts to die. Now, I would say, though, even though I've said that on this issue for once, I do agree with Zelensky, that part of the reason this continuous narrative in the West exists is precisely because the Ukrainians have spent so much time and political capital minimizing the extent of their losses. They are giving Western governments and Western commentators the story that Russia's losses are magnitudes greater than Ukraine, that Ukraine has not suffered especially severe losses, unlike Russia, which allegedly has. And so, of course, that inevitably leads some people in the West to think, especially if they believe this fantasy, that It's something of a puzzle in that case, why the Russians are able to advance, why they seem to be able to outnumber the Ukrainians. Surely it must be because the Ukrainians are not using their manpower efficiently, and all they need to do is to do that, and then everything on the battlefronts will be right. If you tell one story that is plainly false, and I've said many times that I believe I know the true level of Ukrainian casualties up to the 1st of August, know it, well, from authoritative sources, that's all I will say. And I know how bad they really are. But if you provide false information about something as important as this, then almost inevitably that is going to result in further problems. And this is one that we see. Anyway, let's now discuss certain other things that also happened over the course of the last 24 hours. The Ukrainians did carry out their own big drone strike against Russia also last night. And according to the Ukrainian General Staff, they also launched some of their famous Flamingo missiles. These missiles, with the prodigious range, that have an even longer range than the Tomahawks and can reach targets deep inside Russia. Well, I don't know whether that is true or not. All I will say is that from what I can judge, all of the attacks took place in Western Russia. The Ukrainians did not attempt to strike targets in Central Russia or in Siberia or in the Urals or in places of that kind. And insofar as they appear to have hit any target, it was the port of Novorossiysk on the Black Sea. And there are pictures of an attack on what looks like some kind of Russian oil installation there. And incidentally, and for the record, the claims are that this attack was carried out using drones rather than the Flamingo missiles. I am not entirely certain, as of the moment of making this programme, that the Flamingo missiles even exist. Perhaps they do, but probably not in very big quantities. And I doubt that the Ukrainians are able to sustain big in-depth strikes using them against targets deep inside Russia. As I said already, as I said in my programme yesterday, the Flamingo missile is now a topic of the big corruption crisis that is taking place inside Ukraine. Now, the Russians are claiming that they shot down nearly all the drones that Ukraine launched, and I believe that is true, by the way. They haven't yet commented on the attack on Novorossiysk, though no doubt they will. And again, I will return to this topic tomorrow. But my own view is that when we get all of the information about these two strikes, the big Russian strike that took place last night and the Ukrainian strike that was conducted at the same time as the Russian strike, it will once again underline and re-emphasize the colossal imbalance in striking power between the two sides. I suspect that we will learn that the Russian strike was devastating and that the Ukrainian strike, in terms of Russia's energy complex and its overall economy, has again basically done no more than scratched the paint. In my opinion, and I've said this in many places now, if you want to understand where the Russian economy is at this moment, don't waste your time dwelling on Ukrainian drone strikes. Look at what the Russian central bank is doing with interest rates. That is the major factor, interest rate policy, that determines the pace of the Russian economy at any particular moment. I doubt that even the sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil, which the United States announced, and which I am sure are having a bigger impact on Russian economic decisions than the Ukrainian drone attacks and Ukraine's sporadic missile strikes, have anything like the same impact on Russia's macroeconomic situation as the central bank monetary policy and the central bank's efforts to cool an overheating economy, an economy that was overheating last year, and to bring down inflation. That's absolutely my view. I know I get some pushback about it, but I have no doubt that it is so. Anyway, on the subject, by the way, of sanctions, I noticed that the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, came out and said, after the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, that the United States has essentially run out of things in Russia it can still sanction, which, by the way, is obviously true. About a couple of weeks ago, back in October, when the US Treasury imposed the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, the media in the United States spoke about how the United States had other potential sanctions against Russia in its pipeline. Rubio is now sort of hinting that that might not be the case. And I have to say, I did wonder when I read his comments whether there are some people in Washington who are even beginning to wonder whether the sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft were themselves such a good idea. There's said to be concerns in Europe that problems with pipeline, with refineries, Lukoil oil or owned refineries in Romania and Bulgaria, might cause an oil shortage. And there are always worries, of course, in the United States, especially at a time of sticky inflation in the United States with all the political damage that is causing for the president, that there must always be concerns about pressure to increase sanctions. In a program we recently did with him on the Duran, Robert Barnes, the US attorney, said that the pressure to impose the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft came from the Treasury, from US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who continues to believe that the Russian economy is fragile and all that it needs is a little push and it will come collapsing down. And I suspect that is true. I suspect the State Department, which does have its own intelligence agency, by the way, is on this issue now more sceptical, even though the State Department, to my knowledge, is heavily dominated by neocon thinking. But I suspect that the Treasury still finds it very difficult to give up the idea that sanctions against Russia won't be effective eventually. And in order to get a sense of what the Treasury does, just consider the discussions between Prime Minister Orbán of Hungary and President Trump of the United States, which took place about a week ago. Orbán came away from that meeting with Trump saying that the United States has lifted sanctions, permanently lifted sanctions, on Hungary's oil and gas imports from Russia. Orbán appeared to believe, and Hungary's foreign minister, Péter Szijjártó, also appeared to believe, that Hungary had secured from the United States permanent sanctions relief. And I have no doubt at all, given that Orbán and Szijjártó are, in my opinion, serious people, that they are accurately reproducing what Donald Trump actually promised them. But within a few hours of Orbán and Szijjártó saying that, articles started to appear in Reuters and in the American media, clearly sourced from the US Treasury, which said that the sanctions relief Hungary had been given was only for 1 year. So we see that the president says one thing, the Treasury tries to do something else, and I would not be surprised if the same is true about what Rubio is saying. Rubio, perhaps starting to have doubts about the wisdom of the sanctions and about the effectiveness, but I suspect that Scott Bessent and the Treasury, absolutely implacable. And you can understand why, incidentally, because the Treasury has a whole department which exists to do nothing else than impose sanctions. That's why the United States now issues sanctions literally by the day. There's a whole bureaucracy within the US Treasury whose job it is to do that. And coming to these people and telling them, well, you know what you are doing doesn't work, is absolutely not the message they want to hear. As somebody who is a grizzled veteran of state bureaucracies and knows about how bureaucracies work, telling a bureaucracy, a state bureaucracy, like the sanctions bureaucracy within the Treasury, the sanctions are ineffective, is in effect telling these people, what's your purpose? What is the point of you? And of course, that is always a message which a bureaucracy of that kind and the people who work in it will always resist. So that is why, if you ever get onto the sanctions escalator in relation to any country, the escalator will always go upward. Whatever the political views of the president and of the Secretary of State, the pressure from within the Treasury Department and its various allies on this question across the bureaucracy will always be to escalate and increase sanctions and never at any point in time to rescind them. Countries that have to deal with the United States need to understand this and understand that if there are ever sanctions, the United States is never going to reverse them. Anyway, that is, to some extent, a diversion. Let me turn now again to the military situations and on the battlefronts, and they have indeed been dramatic. We've had further news from Zaporozhye, from the Zaporozhye front lines. And, of course, Zelensky went to Orekhov, where, as I said, there is still apparently a functional brigade left of the Ukrainian military there. Apparently it's one of the best remaining brigades that Ukraine still has. And there is some speculation in the Russian media today that this brigade is going to be reassigned from Orekhov to the area of Guliapolye to contain the crisis there. The problem with doing that, however, is that Orekhov itself is now under pressure. The Russians are immediately to the southeast of Orekhov. About 2 weeks ago, the Russians appear to have captured the greater part of the village of Malaya Tokmachka, which is located immediately to the southwest of Orekhov. They haven't captured all of it. There is still a large prison complex, which the Ukrainians have turned into a fortified position that lies to the south, and that is still under Ukrainian control. But anyway, the Russians are very close to Orekhov itself. The Russians also have, of course, well-established positions south of Orekhov in that once famous village of Robotino, which the Ukrainians fought so desperately to capture over the course of their 2023 summer counteroffensive. Robotino is now firmly under Russian control. And as I remember, it's located only about a few hours away from Orekhov itself. As I remember, the assumption at the start of Ukraine's summer 2023 offensive is that Ukrainian troops advancing from Orekhov would be able to capture Robotino over the course of the first day of Ukraine's summer offensive. So that is how close to Orekhov Robotino itself is. And of course, the Russians are also strongly positioned to the west of Orekhov. The Russians are continuing their advances along the east bank of the Dnieper River towards the city of Zaporozhye. As I discussed in a program recently, the Ukrainians have now had to withdraw, or evacuate rather, the population from certain villages immediately south of the city of Zaporozhye itself. And the importance of that is that that puts the Russians in a strong position to complete clearing the small fortified town of Stepnogorsk. The reports are that that has now almost entirely fallen under Russian control. And if the Russians control Stepnogorsk, then that also puts them in a position where they can attack towards Orekhov from the west. So transferring a strong brigade guarding Orekhov, transferring it to the east to deal with the crisis around Guliapolye, risks a Russian attack on Orekhov. And, well, some would say, I would say, that Orekhov is even more important than Guliapolye, which is the town in the east of Zaporozhye region, which the Russians are strengthening. And if the Ukrainians were to lose Orekhov, well, they would very quickly lose Guliapolye after that, and it would be an even bigger crisis for them. But I am not an expert on these things. It may be that the Ukrainians do have a plan and that they can transfer this brigade from Orekhov to Guliapolye and the areas around it, and that there's still enough men to hold Orekhov. And it could also be that the Battle of Stepnogorsk still has some way to go, and the Battle of Malaya Tokmachka also undoubtedly still has some way to go, and the risk of doing it would not be so great. Perhaps more interesting in immediate terms, however, is Zelensky's trip to the Pokrovsk area. Because Zelensky, the same man who a week ago was saying that there were only 260 Russian troops in the whole of Pokrovsk, who said it was completely untrue that the Russians had encircled the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk, the man who said that the Ukrainians were conducting a mopping up operation in Pokrovsk, and though the situation there was difficult, it was very, very far from critical, the man who was saying that Russian claims about Pokrovsk were all lies. Anyway, over the course of this visit, not to Pokrovsk itself, but to the areas around it, Zelensky said that, yes, he had no objection at all for a Ukrainian withdrawal from Pokrovsk. It was untrue that he was demanding that the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk fight to the bitter end, that, on the contrary, it was for the military and the military to make the decision, and he would accept whatever decision the military had made. And, well, I take that as conclusive confirmation that the Russians are indeed now in full control of Pokrovsk. There may still be some mopping up to do for the Russians in one or two places, but even Zelensky is now reconciled to the reality that Pokrovsk has passed completely under Russian control. Now, a couple of days ago, I discussed a public argument that took place between the chief of Ukraine's general staff, General Gnatov, and Zelensky himself, a quarrel that took place in public. There was film of it, over the course of which Gnatov told Zelensky that in connection with the Pokrovsk situation, the Ukrainian general staff was going to make certain important military decisions, that these military decisions would not be disclosed until the full consequences of them became clear, that doing so would be risky, disclosing the information would be risky, disclosing it prematurely, and that Zelensky himself was clearly extremely unhappy and was pushing back against Gnatov and was saying that holding on to Pokrovsk was essential, and that if Pokrovsk were to fall, amongst other consequences, it would undermine Ukraine's claims that it was holding back the Russians in Donbass, and that might cause Western support, especially American support, for further sanctions against Russia and more weapons deliveries to Ukraine. It might cause that support to weaken. And that whole discussion played out, as I said, in public. And I said at the time that this was unprecedented, that there has never been anything quite like this up to now. And that, by the way, remains true. I think we can now reconstruct with some accuracy what actually happened. The general staff, the Ukrainian general staff, took the decision that Pokrovsk was lost and ordered the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk to evacuate and to retreat to Mirnograd. And Zelensky was very unhappy about that decision and tried to countermand it, but the Ukrainian general staff insisted that it would make the decision. And probably the Ukrainian general staff's intention and plan, one backed by General Sirsky, was that the Ukrainians would then recapture Rodinska to the north of the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd conurbation, and that they would then open a way for the Ukrainian army to break through to Mirnograd from the north and either resupply the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd, or perhaps more realistically, arrange for their evacuation. Now, Zelensky was not happy with that idea because he doesn't like retreats from any positions. But ultimately, the logic of the situation was inescapable, and he agreed with it. Now, if I'm right about that, then that suggests again that even the Ukrainian general staff has lost touch with the reality of the situation, because Mirnograd is actually located deeper inside the cauldron, the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd cauldron, than Pokrovsk is. So that by ordering them to transfer from Pokrovsk to Mirnograd, the Ukrainian general staff was telling the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk to go further, deeper inside the Russian trap. My guess is that what created all this confusion and muddle was again a cascade of false reports about the supposed success of the Ukrainian counterattacks in the areas of Rodinska and Kucherov Yar and all of those sorts of places. Anyway, we've had more information about the battle there, and it's come from various sources, from Radovka, which gave an up-to-date account of the battle in this area, northeast of Pokrovsk and north of Mirnograd. And, well, according to the Russians, and we're getting more and more information about this, according to the Russians, the Ukrainians did indeed conduct attacks, and they did at one point indeed actually break into Rodinska, but they were unable to consolidate there or break through in Rodinska. Rodinska remained overall in Russian control. And then after these counterattacks, Ukrainian counterattacks, lost momentum, the Russians themselves attacked. And this morning, there are reports circulating right across the Russian internet that the important village of Sharkovo, to the northeast of Pokrovsk, in this very same area, that Sharkovo, together with Vladimirovka and all of these other places, has now indeed been captured in full by the Russians. Now, there is no official confirmation of this from the Russian Defense Ministry, but I suspect it is true. I've already said in previous programs that the Russians appeared to have largely encircled Sharkovo, and I can imagine that the Ukrainian troops in Sharkovo, in order to avoid this encirclement, escape this encirclement, withdrew across the fields, allowing the Russians to take full control. And if this is correct, and I believe it is, then that solidifies the Russian presence north of Mirnograd and Pokrovsk. In which case, the possibility, even the theoretical possibility, of breaking open the cauldron in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, has gone, and the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd are now conclusively doomed. There's been some claims about the situation inside the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd conurbation. I haven't yet seen the latest update from the Russian Defense Ministry, but there are reports that the entire territory of southern Mirnograd has either been captured by the Russians or has been, or is about to be. There is video footage of Russian soldiers on the Dmitrov mine, located just to the east of Mirnograd, but I believe the Russians have been in control of this mine already for some time. If these reports are indeed true, that the Russians control southern Mirnograd, or are about to gain control of southern Mirnograd, then, as I've said already, the entirety of the territory within the cauldron, where there is still Ukrainian resistance, has probably shrunk to about a quarter of the size that it was, say, a week ago. And the Ukrainians are now tightly trapped. What the Ukrainian General Staff, what Zelensky is going to do in connection with all that, I have absolutely no idea. Now, I should say that there is a view that all of these trips by Zelensky, the trips to Orekhov and the trips to Pokrovsk and the journey to Greece, were all intended by him to divert attention from the corruption crisis that is continuing to rage like a fire in Kiev. What Zelensky was seeking to do was to give the impression that he is there in full control. He's still the overall president, the battlefield commander, and all of these things. And he believes that appearing close to his troops, close to the places where the battles are being fought, that all of this somehow strengthens his position and strengthens his position politically in Kiev. Now, I am sure that this does indeed represent part of what has happened. But to be clear, the battlefield crisis Ukraine is facing is already so bad that it would be entirely in character for Zelensky to visit these places anyway, even if there was no crisis in Kiev. Zelensky seems to have this extraordinary belief that his mere presence boosts morale amongst Ukraine soldiers. That might have been true at one time. I doubt it is the case anymore, by the way. But beyond that, his decisions to visit the troops and their officers, their commanders on the front lines, is also his way of ensuring their loyalty, even as the crisis on the front lines deepens. So, probably the political crisis in Kiev is playing a role, but the military crisis is playing, I suspect, the even bigger role. In truth, in my opinion, the political and the military crisis and the economic crisis that Ukraine is facing, all of them go together. There would not be the political crisis in Kiev that we are seeing now if the situation on the front lines was actually stable. The political crisis is a function of the military crisis. And the economic crisis also is a product of the war, rather, I should say, the energy crisis and the budgetary crisis are a function of the war. Every part of this is part of a single whole. It is the product of a war in which Ukraine now is rapidly descending. Again, there is an unwillingness on the part of some people in the West to acknowledge this truth, but to say it straightforwardly, to me it is obvious, and the amount of energy and investment and commitment that would now be needed to turn the situation round is frankly so great that I just don't think that the political will in the West exists any longer to have it done. I said that there are some people who still have illusions about this. One of them I noticed was the former head of the British intelligence services. He's just given a long interview, very uninteresting interview mostly, I thought, by the way, to the Financial Times. It didn't stay up on their front page, by the way, for very long. But anyway, I noticed and was left gasping by his claim that the war in Ukraine is still winnable. This is an interview this person gave in Istanbul. He said that the war is still winnable. Vladimir Putin is part cold-blooded realist, part ideologue. In the war in Ukraine, it is the ideologue who prevails. His fixation to reconstruct the Russian Empire and his belief that Ukraine has no right to exist, that in this conflict, the ideologue and the cold-eyed realists in Putin are supposedly in conflict with each other. All you need to do is ramp up the sanctions even further to the point where Putin's position in Moscow will be under threat. And if you do that, Putin will end the war and the West will win, and therefore the conflict remains winnable still. I have to say, this interview left me gasping, and it does really seriously make me wonder about the kind of intelligence, if that's the right word, about Russia that the British intelligence agencies are working with. In my opinion, to the extent that there is a potential challenge to Putin in Moscow, it does not come from people who want him to end the war, and he would run risks, not if he continues the war, including under sanctions pressure, but from people, the challenge comes from people who think he is not going hard and fast enough, and who would challenge him if he ended the war prematurely before Russia's goals were achieved. That is the reality in Russia today. It has no connection at all what British intelligence appears to believe. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell on that, but as I said, analysis, if this is the analysis that the British government is getting about Putin's calculations, then in my opinion, they could not be more completely wrong. Anyway, let's move on. Let's not waste time, maybe, with the erroneous ideas of British intelligence officers. I will round out with a quick summary of the situation on the front lines. Russian officials are saying this morning that the battle for Kupiansk is indeed almost ended. There's claims from various Russian officials that the Ukrainians are conducting what they call a reorganization of their forces in the Kupiansk area, which suggests that further attempts by the Ukrainians to break the cauldron in Kupiansk are now being abandoned. And there are reports that the Russians have captured an important village near Volchansk, And this is supposed to have some bearing on the battle in Kupiansk. I'm not sure how and why. Others can no doubt explain that. But anyway, the Russians seem to be confident that the battle of Kupiansk is now at an end. And these same Russian officials, and I am talking about Russian officials, are now saying that the battle for Liman is now seriously restarting, and that the Russians are now making a concerted push to clear Liman as well. So it could be that in the Siversk-Liman area, we're going to start to see important events over the next couple of days. And in Zaporozhye region, the Russians continue to enlarge the area of control that they have now achieved along the main road leading to Guliapolye from the north. Yesterday, they captured the village of Danilovka. They appear to be expanding the territory they control along the road southwards towards Guliapolye. As I've said already, I believe that what they're now going to try and do is clear the villages along this road on the west of this road. And then, of course, they will move towards a complete encirclement of Guliapolye as well. And, well, for the record, I think that rather than try and send this brigade in Orekhov to try to save the situation in Guliapolye, the much wiser thing for the Ukrainians to do is to acknowledge the reality that Guliapolye is also going to be lost and to pull back from there. But I don't believe that that is what they're going to do. Ensuring that the disaster that is going to happen in Guliapolye is going to be even greater than what we have seen. Overall, it remains my view that once Pokrovsk, Mirnograd fall, once Kupiansk fall, the priority for the Russians is going to be to continue the battle for Donbass, to complete the battle for Donbass, to capture Liman and Siversk, and then Konstantinovka, where the Russians appear to be making more advances, and then to encircle the remaining Ukrainian troops in Donbass, in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, to win the battle of Donbass and to break Ukrainian resistance there. And of course, the Russians, now that they outnumber the Ukrainians, will no doubt continue their existing offensives in Zaporozhye region and in Kharkiv region. But I think that those offensives will only be brought to full fruition with potential attacks, who knows, maybe on Zaporozhye city and Pavlograd and the city of Dnipro and on Kharkiv itself, if that's not too ambitious, that the Russians will only do that once the key battle of Donbass has been done. Once Donbass is won, the Russians will have broken Ukraine's main defense lines and a war of maneuver begins to become more possible. And at that point, operations in Kherson region, in Zaporozhye, against the city of Zaporozhye, along the Dnieper in the north, become not only more practical, but much more attractive. Assuming, of course, that Ukraine does not sue for peace, and I don't believe it will, and assuming that the West doesn't come to its senses, and I don't believe it is going to do that either. Just saying. And, well, obviously, the Russians will want to advance to the Dnieper. And after the discussions that took place in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, a month ago, I've no doubt that the ultimate objective would be to cross the Dnieper in along its southern banks, obviously to recapture Kherson, but ultimately to capture Ukraine's entire Black Sea coastline, including the important towns of Odessa, Nikolaev, Ochakov, all of these places which were once captured and built up by the Russian Tsars, Catherine the Great, and her successors. I personally believe that that is the Russian plan. And of course, in the meantime, Russia will continue its missile and drone strikes, and these will build up with intensity, because I don't believe we are anywhere close to the point where the full Russian drone offensive against Ukraine will come. I know of at least two drone factories, big drone factories that the Russians are building. One of them apparently using North Korean labor, may be located even in North Korea. And by the way, on the subject of North Korea, there have been incredible numbers of conversations and discussions and meetings between North Korean officials and Russian officials over the last few weeks and months. The level of interaction between the Russian and North Korean governments over the last few months is astonishing. It perhaps explains the growing self-confidence that I've started to see in North Korea. I suspect that Russian energy supplies and technical help, and perhaps resumptions of fertilizer deliveries, are aiding in what I have no doubt will be a major upswing in the North Korean economy. And so you could start to sense that Kim Jong-un and his officials, they're looking increasingly more confident recently. At least that's how it appears to me. And of course, the North Koreans are again present close to the battlefronts. They've sent logistics troops to areas in Western Russia, bordering Ukraine. There's no word that they're actually participating in the actual special military operation itself, at least no such reports so far. But the Russians themselves have now released film showing North Korean troops in Western Russia carrying out reconstruction work and singing North Korean songs, even as they do. So anyway, it's perhaps worth saying that a North Korean-Russian alliance has indeed now developed, and that is inevitably going to have a major impact on the situation in the Northeast Pacific region. And I am puzzled, frankly, that it is not getting anything like the kind of attention that it deserves. But anyway, that is where I'm going to finish today. The military situation continues to deteriorate. Zelensky continues to be the president. I don't believe he's going to lose his position anytime soon in Ukraine. But there is no plan, no idea in the West about what to do in this situation. Rubio is starting to push back against the idea of further sanctions against Russia, though the pressure to impose them continues to be there. But China and Russia remain clear allies. Russia and North Korea, as I've said, are now open and visible allies. The Russians and the Indians appear to be continuing work on Putin's visit to India. There are some claims that it's going to happen on the 3rd of December, that it'll start on the 3rd of December, but there is no confirmation either from the Indian government or the Russian government that this is so. There are reports of big economic and military deals between Russia and India being prepared. Well, we shall see. Anyway, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. And by the way, also on Substack now. Look up the Duran on Substack. And by the way, I'm now writing articles again, both for Substack, and you can also find these articles on Locals. And you can also, of course, support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. And last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to join and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.